Returning to the decade of the 1940s in Grand Rapids, during the course of those years, the suggestions that the old courthouse building be replaced by a new structure aroused considerable controversy. The handsome building, constructed in typical 1890s Minnesota courthouse style, seemed to many citizens quite adequate. And I'm looking at a picture of it, and boy, it is a beautiful building, a quite large dome on the top, very elaborate roof with cupolas and all kinds of stuff up there, nice stone construction, columns centering around the main entrance. Yeah, really a striking building. It would be nice if it was still there. But because of suspected structural failure in the building, Charles Blandin had advised retaining the services of an architect from outside the area to make an impartial examination. Just before the war, an architect from the Twin Cities checked the building and reported that it was riddled with severe faults that could not be reasonably repaired. But despite full newspaper support and much publicity about the state of the building, the taxpayers, particularly those in the rural sections of the county, rejected a proposed $200,000 bond issue. The question was raised again after the war. The old building was in even worse shape and had been ruled a fire trap by state marshals, who advised that it be razed. The county commissioners gingerly discussed the still sensitive matter before holding public meetings on the issue. Eventually, another bond issue, this time for $500,000, was approved by voters. Work on a new modern structure was well underway by the close of the decade. And, of course, that's the courthouse that is still in use now, right in the middle of town. Pretty prosaic-looking building compared to that ornate older one. But the new one served its purpose well and continues to do so. The large new courthouse was but one of many construction projects launched during the latter 1940s. The town was growing, and the temporary prefabricated structures hurriedly erected after the war were being replaced with permanent buildings. Very few vacant lots remained in the original area of the town, and outward expansion began. New houses are springing up with almost the speed and frequency of dandelions, the Herald Review reported. The paper for a time carried a regular feature on who was building where. The Powers Hill area, just across the river from the mill, especially boomed with new construction. In just 1 2-month period, the city council issued 27 building permits, and a 1949 Herald Review editorial stated, "There's not a block in the business area of the community that has not been marked by great improvements in the past decade." Fire and decay had eliminated most of the original buildings in the downtown area. Noting all the new construction and replacement, the newspaper described the business section as smart and attractive and still able to draw shoppers from a wide area. As the town grew, the city council faced pressures and demands as never before. Sewer and water extension, sewage disposal, and the need for more paved streets, curbs, and sidewalks required expenditures that dwarfed earlier city budgets and led to the first discussions regarding systematic planning and zoning. The city installed its first traffic lights and even acquired a radio station. The character of the town was changing with the close-knit community orientation of an earlier time, giving way to a more detached urban outlook. Lawrence Rossman noted the changing character of Grand Rapids when a reader wrote to the Herald Review that he had lived in the town for a whole year, and no one had made any effort to welcome him or his family or even to get acquainted. The newcomer found others in the same situation, and said he knew one woman who had lived in Grand Rapids for 3 years and never had a caller, except for a few individuals looking for donations. The growing population of the town, Rossman mused, made it impossible to know everyone. Grand Rapids was becoming more like a large city, where even neighbors were not always acquainted, a situation Rossman acknowledged as not in many ways a change for the better, but it is a penalty of progress. Overall, Grand Rapids citizens relish the expansion and prosperity of their town. an end-of-the-year editorial in the Herald Review, judged 1949 as perhaps the best year in its history. In recounting the advantages of the region, the editorial still listed one factor of prime importance to the well-being and future of the new Grand Rapids, and that was the Blandin Paper Company. So, during the prosperous 1940s, the city of Grand Rapids grew, attaining a new degree of sophistication and complexity. The Blandin Paper Company paralleled that course as the one-time newsprint mill matured and expanded into a more elaborate and diversified corporation. At the beginning of the decade, production capacity rose to 150 tons of paper per day. That's almost six times what it was in 1916 when the mill was purchased by the Dispatch Printing Company. Total yearly sales of Grand Rapids paper reached an impressive $3.75 million. Although newsprint still constituted the largest part of the mill output, it was 76% in 1939, groundwood paper production was increasing. During the late 1930s, the national market for newsprint was improving, with rising prices reflecting an increased demand for newspapers. Once again, international tension sparked newspaper readership, as had been the case before World War I. After the outbreak of hostilities in Europe in the fall of 1939, the basic newsprint price rose to $50 per ton, a somewhat reasonable price after the years of $40 per ton bankruptcy rates. Newsprint mills across the country began increasing their productivity, reaching 93% of U.S. capacity by the end of 1940. But newsprint manufacturers of experience could easily forecast a recovery of only limited duration. Long-range stability for the U.S. newsprint industry appeared no more likely than it had been five decades earlier. Canadian production had also risen to meet new demand, and while the lack of tariff restrictions on newsprint aided readers by keeping newspaper costs down, United States newsprint manufacturers remained frustrated by lower profits. Newsprint was still produced at less cost in Canada than in most sections of the United States, and the competition from north of the border was relentless. Well-meaning and well-conducted, but essentially fruitless, United States congressional investigations remained a part of the newsprint scene. And they're once again using that same old argument, the newspapers stand for democracy, and the selfish makers of newsprint are trying to make money off it, and in doing so, they are harming the very structure of the country. So investigations were a continued source of harassment. The Federal Trade Commission kept a watchful eye. In a scenario reminiscent of World War I, the commission investigated newsprint price-fixing charges leveled against Pacific Coast producers. Despite producer claims of innocence, the commission levied fines and the firms paid. Because of World War II government economic controls, the exorbitant charges for newsprint that characterized World War I were not repeated. Newsprint sold for $58 per ton in 1943 and $67 per ton by the end of the war in 1945. Nevertheless, because of a wartime shortage of pulp and increased costs for other materials, newsprint manufacturers claimed the price was too low and they could not make a fair profit. And an announcement of extreme importance for the future of the company in Grand Rapids is about to be announced by C.K. Blandin. Next time.